A gute Woche. Back to the subject of Hannah and Shmuel. I remember that we began the subject. What's that? A while back. I remember we spoke about it. It's been 2 weeks. Shmuel's time. Yeah, that's right. That's right. We discussed we actually discussed, if you remember, before Shmuel was born, Hannah's childlessness, Elkanah, etc. I was trying to remember exactly what we discussed. I couldn't remember. I think that we were basically, I've got, no, it doesn't really matter because not necessarily going in order. We'll be touching on different subjects. So I want to discuss now again back to that subject, but now the point past her tefillah. I think that we actually spent a shiur elaborating on her tefillah. And now we'll go to the point past her tefillah. Everyone's familiar with the general story about how she was childless for a long time. And she went to the Mishkan to put in the very powerful tefillah. The elaboration is in those shiurim. But so now, we'll start our discussion from the moment this week, from the moment she finished her tefillah. Now she is standing in the Azara, right, in the courtyard of the Mishkan. As we discussed, this was a time that the Azara was pretty much empty because this was Yom Tov afternoon, or enough afternoon, noon time, at the time when people were basically at home.
I'll tell you about that later on, is that?
People were at home eating their sudas. And her family was also, as we saw, she left in the middle of the meal at home. So the Azara is basically empty, except for one person who Hashem orchestrated should be there at that time. And this was Eli, the Kohen Gadol. The truth is, it wasn't a complete surprise that he was there because this was his derech. It was his want to generally try to be there as much as he possibly can in order to constantly be drawing off the ruchnius of the Azara. As familiar as he was with the Mishkan, and as much as he was there as the Kohen Gadol all the time, he still cherished every moment of being there. So even though there wasn't really anything happening there right now, he was sitting there right at the entrance to the Mishkan. And she was off to the side doing her tefillah, and he was conscious of her presence. He was watching her, and he was starting to get uncomfortable. Why? So, as we discussed, her tefillah ended up serving as a model for many of the Hilchos tefillah that we have today. But she was standing there in a corner and basically mumbling to herself. To him, that had the look of intoxicated. And he considered himself responsible for upholding the standards of the Makom HaMikdash. Now, we have to realize that back then, this is a sentiment that's not less popular today, but a very, very, very important element of the atmosphere of the Mishkan was the sense of awe and reverence. It wasn't the place where you came to just be Hamish and express yourself however you want. They were very, very makbid on the awe and reverence in the atmosphere of the Mikdash. Part of the point being that when you entered the zone of the Mishkan, you were sensing, encountering something much bigger and awesome than you. And that's why there are so many very severe halachas about behavior in and around the Mikdash. And this was unusual. Now, this interesting discussion in the Poskim, if it actually emerges, we learn from Chana that it's appropriate, the appropriate way to daven is in undertones, not to be davening loud, to be davening under your breath and in a voice that can't be heard. And there's chashuva reasons for that. Why is that? Well, one of the classic reasons given by the Poskim is that tefillah, the essence of tefillah, is meant to be a very intimate interaction between you and Hashem with nobody else a part of it. It's just you and Hashem. And as soon as it can be heard by others, it's compromising the intimate nature of the conversation, the interaction. So the Poskim discuss, so why was Eli taken? Why was he taken aback by the fact that she was mumbling? Wouldn't that have been the standard way of davening anyways? We won't get into that. I'm just noting the question. But whatever the case is, he thought that she was intoxicated, so he took her to task. That was part of his job. He took her to task, and she responded sharply. She said, this is how Chazal put it down, she said something to the effect of, "You're the person carrying Ruach HaKodesh in our times. You're the Navi of Klal Yisrael. With all of your Ruach HaKodesh, you weren't able to see that this is not a case of drunkenness, but a case of a woman who's pouring out her heart from a place of pain and bitterness." She kind of told him off in response. And then she immediately softened her tone, as Rashi says, and said that, "Forgive me for the way I just expressed myself. I was talking from a place of pain." Whatever the case is, Eli was a great man, did feel bad that he had spoken to her that way, that he had judged her wrongly, and therefore he decided he's going to compensate her by giving her the bracha she was looking for. Apparently, brachas weren't just cheap in those days, and he saw this as a proper compensation for the pain he had caused her. He told her, "Yitein Hashem es she'laseich hasheshalt me'imon." He told her, "Hashem will grant you." Sorry, I'm just gonna find the. Hashem will grant you the request that you're making of him.
This could you learn.
Oh, that's right. That's right. This is the source of the concept that if you suspect someone wrongly, you should give them a bracha. This is the precedent for that. Okay, now for her, this might have sounded like a casual apology, but for her, she experienced this as, "This is the turning point of my life. So my fate now changed. Eli the Kohen Gadol just told me, the Elokei Yisrael yitein she'laseich hasheshalt me'imoy." So that's it. As far as she was concerned, her troubles were over. She had reached the end of the road.
I've heard, you see this in Mishpacha magazine and stuff, that if you personally have been embarrassed by somebody, wrongly embarrassed, and instead of like lashing back or being angry, you have the power to give a bracha that you never had before. Have you ever heard of that? Do you know what that is? Could she have had, because he wrongly embarrassed her, could she personally have basically been able that child to be born without his bracha?
So let's break that in. That's an interesting question. You're asking why she retorted to him and then got his bracha. Perhaps she could have utilized the koyach of not responding when you're offended to utilize that koyach to get the bracha. So first of all, let's just say that when we say that she's retorted, it doesn't mean that she lost it. It means that she said it, and this is actually something, let's realize it in halacha. The Rambam says this, that if you're hurt, you should state it in a benefit-oriented kind of way, not just to hold it against the person, etc. Now, could she have used that koyach? I don't know. There would be good reason why she would have justified herself anyways, because when a person is nechshad, when a person is suspected of wrongdoing, a person is not supposed to just leave that hanging. She was actually suspected of wrongdoing, of acting inappropriately in the Azara. And she clarified it, just perhaps she used a little bit of a sharper tone. But it would have been wrong to actually just leave that impression hanging for her to turn around and back out. So I don't know. It's also possible that the answer would have been no. Maybe she didn't need the bracha of this very great man. I don't know. I don't know. Okay. So again, once he said those words, as far as she was concerned, she had a baby. And therefore, she told him, "Timtzo shivchas chochein be'einecha." In other words, she thanked him, and she even asked him to continue davening for her. And then it says she came back home. The lashon of the pasuk is vatelecha yisha ledarka. She went back her way, meaning she went back to where her family was. Vatoichal, and she ate. Ufanele hayula oid, and her face was no longer the same, meaning she came home not recognizable. It was a different face when she walked back into the house. It was not recognizable as the woman who had left an hour ago. She came back as a different woman. She was vitalized. She was full of energy. She was full of joy. This was an Ema Banim Semecha. This was a woman who was the mother of a family that she was happy and proud and full of joy, even though she hadn't even conceived yet. And that's why the also stresses. She ate, meaning she suddenly came back. She had a hard time eating, right? That was since she left with her food on the table. Now she had an appetite. She was a busy mother. And this is how she came back home. Okay? And then, of course, what happened was that shortly after this, she conceived. And she had that child after a short pregnancy, a little over 6 months, Chazal tell us. And she named him Shmuel. Shmuel is a mixing together the words Shaul Mekel. Shaul Mekel. It's mixing together those two words, in which she was basically going to put into his name a monument to how he was born, that he was begged of Hashem. And here we move into the next stage of Chana's life. We're not yet up to the story of Shmuel. This is still the story of Chana. Chana had made a commitment that I will commit him, dedicate him to Hashem all of his life. Now, parents don't control their children's choices. There's no way a parent can come and say, this child is going to be committed to Hashem his whole life. What was she saying? She was saying, I'm going to dedicate him. I'm going to commit him, which meant two things. Obviously, she's not able to control what he's actually going to decide, but she was basically including two commitments the Mefarshim bring out in her statement. Number one, she is going to invest her all, every last fiber of her being, into putting him onto that track. That would be the sole thing guiding her in her raising him. That was number one. And as we discussed earlier, I think we did mention this back when we were talking about Chana's tefillah. Let's understand what her vision was for him. It wasn't just that she wanted her own child, what we discussed back then. You know what? Let's first say the second element and then we'll get back to that. The second thing that she said was that as soon as she deems him capable of it, she would move him out of her jurisdiction to wherever he could get the best possible exposure and tutelage. She would overcome her very intense motherly feelings in order to move him to the highest place possible. Those are the two commitments that were included. And when she said, I'm going to dedicate him to Hashem his entire life. Now, I'm going back to her tefillah, where we mentioned back then that her tefillah, actually, as Chazal pointed out, it had almost a certain brazen element to it. She davened, the way Chazal say it, she was mityach dvarim klapei mala. She like thrust things at Hashem as though she was. You remember, there were various parts of her tefillah that were stated very strongly. And as we discussed back then, this is not an encouraged manner of davening. Davening has to be submissive. You have to know your place with Hashem when you come to daven to him. The Gemara already notes that there were a couple of great people. Moshe, Eliyahu, Chana were noted as people who actually formulated such tefillahs, and it says, don't do it, it's dangerous. It was good for them. And then it quotes one of the great Chachamim of the Gemara who expressed himself in such a way and became lame as a result. His tefillah was answered, but he became lame as a result. So you have to be very careful. When you're dealing with Hashem, you have to remember who you're dealing with. You can't take liberties. But Rav Dessler speaks at length about what was it that gave her the license to express herself the way she did. It was the fact that it wasn't only her own personal angle that she was asking for, but that she was pushing an agenda of Kvod Shamayim, meaning as follows. We already discussed. She was davening not just for her own personal story, but she was davening for a child as a rep she was davening as a representative of Klal Yisrael, as a representative of Hashem, even. She was begging for a child. Why? She was very, very attuned to the state of the Jewish people and the state of Hashem's honor. And as we discussed, things had been deteriorating throughout the period of the Shoftim. The situation in the Mishkan was at a not in a very great place. And she, with her attunedness and her spiritual sensitivities, was really understanding that Klal Yisrael are reaching a certain low they can't really continue. Things are going to have to change. Klal Yisrael in general, the course of Jewish history is going to have to change. In what way? I don't know. We actually saw in her tefillah that she did have a bit of an idea of how, but we know how it was going to change. The period of the shoftim, of the self-governing, was basically exhausting itself, and Klal Yisrael was going to have to move into the period of the malachim. And she understood that there's going to have to be very, very great people involved in turning around the course of Jewish history and getting it onto a better track. And she was saying, if you give me a child, I have the ability. She understood her own ruchniyus power. She understood what she can put into a child. And she was basically coming not from a place, not just from a place of her own personal pain, but from a place of her pain for because of the state of Kvod Shamayim in the world. And she was saying, I have it in me to raise the child who will be able to turn the tides. That was part of what she was begging for. It was motivated by her pain for the state of Klal Yisrael in general. That was part of what she was begging for. And this is what, now when she was given the child, she was actually given that task. Okay, go ahead, raise that child who now is going to be the person to turn the tide, to really change the course of Jewish history. And she did have it in her. And her chinuch, I can't even describe it, meaning just even trying to touch it is way beyond us, because at what age did she actually send him on to the next stage?
3 years old.
Two. She was two, which means that she packed all that chinuch that she was describing, she packed in 2 years. So let's touch what we can touch of it, while realizing that we're dealing with things that are outside our frame of reality. So let's touch what we could touch of it. So first of all, what the Navi tells us is that, as we discussed, Elkanah, this was his special innovation in Klal Yisrael, making a big deal out of every Aliyah L'Regel, right? We discussed this back in the day. That was a very major part of the way he raised his family. They used to go up to the Regel with the whole family, with a great commotion. That was a major part of his chinuch. That was a major part of his own personal avodah. It was a major part of the way he impacted Klal Yisrael. So, next Regel, and Elkanah is starting the preparations. Elkanah says, I'm staying behind. Now, this was a kiddush in the family. I'm staying behind with Shmuel. That was even more than that, because he was now, he had, when Shmuel was born, he had vowed to bring all kinds of special karbanis in honor of Shmuel's birth. Now is the time that he's going up to fulfill that vow, and Chana is staying, I'm saying, I'm staying behind. Why? So the Mefarshim explained quite how, on top of every last detail of Shmuel's chinuch, going to the Mishkan was a very, had a very powerful impact if you went there the right way. Certainly, if you went there as part of Elkanah's family, going to the Mishkan had a very powerful impact. Her plan was, she said, I want that impact. I'm not ready to do it yet. I don't want him to get that impact and then come back home. I want him to be introduced to it for the first time, when he'll be hit by the impact, and that'll be an impetus. He'll go straight from there to moving on to the next stage of life. He'll stay in the Mishkan. When he's first hit by the immensity of the Mishkan, by the power of the Mishkan, he'll just stay there. And therefore, she said, since he's not ready to leave me yet, I don't know how old he was at the time, but probably under a year, I guess. Yet she was assuming that he would have that impact. Not ready to leave me yet. I don't want to take him to the Mishkan yet. I don't want to waste the experience. I'm going to take him there for the first time when he's actually ready to be catapulted by the experience, and then move on straight out of my hands. So she kept him home. And Elkanah accepted that from her, trusted her judgment, gave his bracha, and his lashon was, Asiyah toiv be'inayich, do as you see fit, shviat gom lechoisoi, stay here with him until you wean him. Achyokim Hashem esvare, and he added his bracha, seeing her resolve, let's talk and see Hashem bear out your visions for him. Okay, finally, the time comes, and he's 2 years old, and Chana figures, okay, I have put everything I could into his chinuch, and at this point, I have nothing more to offer him. Okay. Now, what exactly did that include? I don't know what to tell you. There's a Ramah. There's a say. The Ramah is a Sefer called Torah Sa'ila, which is a very. It's a sefer with a lot of Kabbalah, a very esoteric sefer. I can't, not like a sefer that I can learn. But I just looked there at his description of the things she actually taught him then, and you just come away dizzy and say, okay, forget about it. We get the idea. So that's all I can share with you. In the Torah Sa'ila, he describes it, and you come away dizzy.
Excuse me, I thought he was through when she took it. Yeah, me too. She's not on.
1 minute. I think it was two, but you know what? We'll check that out again. I believe it was two, but we can leave that open. It doesn't impact the story that much. Okay. So now, I do want to add also, yes, by the time he came to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan at 2 years old, he was a prodigy. We're going to see soon that he actually had a full-fledged halachic debate with all the with the Kohanim there, and then with Eli. Now he's busy debating halacha with Eli, as we'll see. So this sounds like one of those stories. And I was like, the Gadol biography story. You open it up, and in the first chapter, they're describing how from the age of one, he knew Kol HaTorah Kula. So how does this add up with what we learned earlier, that she wanted him not to be blessed with supernatural abilities? Remember that? We saw that earlier. So it's important to understand that as this is supernatural in our terms, but there's a combination of two things. First of all, those times are supernatural times, meaning we already discussed a number of times how when in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, here we're talking it before the first Beis HaMikdash, we'll call it the period of the first Beis HaMikdash, with the open and very intense level of Shekhinah B'Yisrael, all of capacities were much more expanded. People were much more advanced on all levels in those days than they are now, in ways that basically relating to the regular, what was going on in the streets at those times, was supernatural. You see that in the time of Chizkiah, it says 6 and 7 year old girls were proficient in all of Taaretz. Taaretz today are areas of Torah that's reserved for the supremely great Talmid Chachamim. Your classic Rav is not well versed in Taaretz. And this, so we're talking about 6, 7 year old girls. So everything then was much more expanded. So we're talking about a child who got a superb chinuch in supernatural times. So he was the top of those times. But presumably in those times, with all the things, all the superlative things that we're hearing about him, it wasn't supernatural in those times. Just making that statement.
Interesting that how the women gave the names of the children always. There were never, in those days, the women named the children.
In many cases, it's true. And it is a point that would be worth studying. So what happens? So first of all, okay, she planned now this. She's finally ready to bring him to the Mishkan. And she's going there with a lot of ambition. So first of all, her chinuch is at its peak. And she went there, first of all, she went there ready to make a very big affair out of it. She brought karbanos along, and she was going to make a big commotion out of the fact that she was now bringing him to this next stage. But she actually went there with a very bold idea. What was her bold idea? Her bold idea was that she was going to come to the Mishkan and then make a request of Eli, no less, of him now taking Shmuel, adopting him for all practical purposes, and turning him into his personal Talmid. I doubt that he got requests like that every day. But she was, again, dedicated to the cause, and she was going to settle for nothing less than the absolutely top level. Meaning a combination of two things. First of all, that he should be taught by Eli, not settling for anything less. And number two, on the Mishkan premises, she wanted him to get as much Ruchnius, as much of the power of Ruchnius as could possibly be. And as we discussed earlier, this was obviously going to require her to overcome her natural motherly instincts. What mother finds it easy to let a child like that out of her care? But we see that she went about it as a great simcha. It was a whole, similar to the style of Elkanah, the way he went up to the other regal. She turned it into a big asik, a big commotion. And she comes. She comes to the Azara. And here's something fascinating happened. They come into the Azara, and she had brought along three bulls to offer as karbanas. As soon as they enter, she handed over the first bull to be shechted. Mafarshim say that this was all part of her chinuch. Rabag says this, that this is part of what she's impressing on him. Anytime we're moving into some endeavor, it starts with some sort of act of avoida to get Hashem siyata d'shmaya, to get his aid. And that's why they enter the Mishkan. The first thing is, she hands over one of the parim, the shechita. So now, something very interesting happened. There was a delay. They didn't shecht it right away. Why? They started looking for a kohen. Now, why were they looking for a kohen? Answer is not because you need a kohen to shecht the bull. Really? No, that the halacha is that Yisrael is kosher to shecht the karban. The essential, the avoid of kohanim starts at the next stage of catching the blood. But really, the Yisrael is able to shecht the karban. That's fine. Just what? Just what? There was a minhag. There was a long-standing minhag, as we see, it goes back to the earliest times, that even though Yisrael could, they only had kohanim do. And that's why now they were looking for a kohen to shecht the karban. And here, two-year-old Shmuel spoke up. And two-year-old Shmuel said as follows. He said, why are you looking for a kohen? Shechita is kosher bizarre. Right? A non-kohen can also do the shechita. So they looked at him like in surprise. But the explanation was the ma'aser, that this is a long-standing minhag. So Shmuel said, I mean, since a two-year-old, Shmuel said, the minhag is a fine minhag, but you always have to weigh one thing against the other. If a karban is standing ready for shechita, the delay is already a little bit of a disgrace to the karban. And the minhag doesn't justify that. Better, he said, to have a Yisrael shecht immediately in order to maintain the atmosphere of the Mishkan of things happen immediately, things happen with rizus, rather than stand on a minhag of finding Yisrael. This is Shmuel's argument to the Kohanim. So this is Shmuel's argument to the Kohanim. What's that? Sorry, I guess whoever it was there, or maybe it wasn't the kohen who could shecht. Yeah, I don't know what that technicality would be. What's that? Apparently not. Apparently, it was only the kohanim. Those who actually did.
Wasn't Eli there? What's Eli that? Was there. If she brought him to Eli, Eli was there, and he's a kohen.
We'll see. Eli is about to come onto the scene.
Wow. Eli is about. That was the whole reason why she brought him back.
What's that?
That was the whole reason, is that she brought, is bringing him back to Eli.
The question was, he exactly there at the time? Was he there on the scene, on the spot? So let's see. So what happens? So this argument is going on, and they're all a little bit taken aback. And again, I don't know where they're not kohanim there, where the kohanim, but they, for whatever reason, they weren't able to shecht. But they went to call Eli. So Eli, now here Shmuel is meeting for the first time Eli, the Gadol HaDor, who Chana is hoping is going to turn into his Rebbe. And we're talking about the old-fashioned style chinuch. Eli did not approve of what was happening here. So the first thing he did was ask Shmuel. He wanted to see, one minute, what's going on here? Is this just the kid chattering? Or does this child actually know what he's talking about? So he started questioning Shmuel. How do you know that an non-kohen can shecht, etc.? And Shmuel answered with ease, with all the sugyas, etc. Now that didn't make Eli happier. That just intensified his disapproval. As Eli said, if he's really that mature and he really understands that much more, then his behavior was that much more inappropriate. Shmuel's argument was that you weren't weighing things properly in terms of the minhag versus keeping the karban waiting. Now, Eli rejoined with, yeah, but you didn't weigh things properly in terms of, could be that you were right in that cheshbon, but coming against you issuing orders when you know that the Kohen Gadol is somewhere on the premises and that the Gadol Hador is somewhere on the premises, that was very bad thinking on your part. And that's Eli's response to him. He said, you might be right with your thinking, but delaying the karban was not an iser, and therefore that didn't warrant that lack of kavod on your part. We do know when there's an actual iser at stake, you speak up without any regard to who, what other great people are here. But he said, this wasn't an iser, and therefore it didn't warrant you coming in and asserting your 2-year-old authority. So this is a little hard for us to swallow, but Eli told him, you know what that halacha is of a person who is Moir Heiro b'fnei Rabbi, of a person who issues a ruling in the presence of his Rebbe, those days of absolute discipline, and where Kavodat Torah was real Kavodat Torah, since such people die. And here Chanastat suddenly saw what was happening here. This is where it was heading. Right? Eli's kpeda was in place. He was not going to just, oh, it's okay, now let's talk. But he was relating to it with the full severity, and she understood now that Shmuel's life was actually in danger. He could be struck down now. So she stepped in. And here she said to Eli, she cried out to Eli. She said, one minute, before you really implement your anger at him, right? You know, it was enough for him to be actively angry to chas v'shalom make it happen. So she said, do you remember the whole incident from back then, how I was here begging, etc.? So Eli, again, the old standards with the old standards, wasn't moved, and he told her, I'll daven for you for another child. So, but then the Mefarshim, how she responded, where the Pasuk says it is, Elanar hazeh ispalalti. No, I wasn't davening for a child. I didn't know him at the time, but this was the child I was davening for. I wasn't davening for any other child. The Mefarshim say, Moshe David Vali says, that she was basically begging him to see it as, yes, he's very great in many ways, but he still is a child. And on the contrary, here she already started pushing her case. Look at where he is now. You're saying that there's something raw about him? If he gets the top tutelage possible, look what he could get to. So she's already starting to push in where she's headed for in terms of what she wanted to ask of him. So she basically told Eli like this. She said, you're right. There was something lacking here. Apparently he needs more chinuch. Now, don't tell me you can ask for a different child. She said, look at all the nace surrounding the birth, his birth. And look at everything that went into his birth. This is very clearly a sign of that Shmuel was destined bin HaShemayim for very great things. And if he needs more chinuch, okay, I'm handing it over to you. And I guess since Eli already knew who she was, and he actually accepted her argument of seeing everything, how all the supernatural elements, all the nace involved that he was seeing in front of him, an actual live nace. So he actually granted her request, and he said, okay, I'm gonna take it. I don't know. Try to think of that in, you know, today after that, now the child is moving into his care. But everyone was fine with it. Eli said, yes, I'm taking him into my care. He's now going to be actually living with Eli now under his chinuch at the age of 2. And Chana was handing him over. And now Shmuel was really entering the next phase of his growth, of his chinuch. He was moving to the next stage of, he's now going to be living on the Mishkan premises, right? First time in the Mishkan. Now he's moving into the stage of actually living there as the direct and closest, most immediate Talmud of Eli HaKohen. Okay, after that, things started moving places very quickly. But we'll leave that for another time.
Question. Couldn't you say that her just handing him over to Eli, that's sort of like sacrificing him, like his life sort of ended and began, like, you know, like his life up until then was over. Now he's dedicated entirely to the temple and to Eli. So in a sort of a way, Eli got his punishment in a sort of a way imposed. You know what I'm
That's
saying?
A very interesting suggestion. The suggesting is that maybe this was kind of a way of being yotze in a conceptual level, that he ended his life. He ended his life of up till then. That's a very nice idea. I hear.
Don't
What
see
I
it
would
in any
just,
Mafarsh,
well, I would
but
actually come back and say what I would say to counter that is that that is not how Chana set it up. Chana set it up as a direct continuum. This is what she was envisioning. This is where she was moving it. And as far as she was concerned, this was the natural continuation of his life. And this is really, he was actually at that threshold now. It wasn't like there was now a sudden twist in his life. This is what it was heading for the whole time. So it's an interesting suggestion. And yeah, that would be my off-the-cuff thought. Ailey's other sons, you mean?
like is she in I think
What
the
happened
children.
with Ailey's other sons? So the truth is that, let's address that briefly. We'll address that briefly. Ailey's other sons, it's important to realize that they're accused, you're referring to what they're accused by the Navi of, that they disgraced the Karbanis and they did all kinds of terrible things with the what's that? How could things have gone so wrong? So it's important to realize Chazal tell us that the criticisms against them, against Chafni and Pinchas, are meant to be taken in the same perspective as many of the other Navi's criticisms. And that is, this may sound surprising, it says, Chafni and Pinchas chatu toya, the same way it says about David HaMelech and Reuven, Yehuda, that they were both very, very great men. They were actually from the Gerle Ador, and here's how Rabbi Avigdor Miller frames it. The accusation against them is said in the Navi terms, in very, very harsh terms, but here's what actually happened. What actually happened was that these were two very, very great people. In fact, it says that when Elkanah went up the Mishkan, it says he used to go up to the Mishkan, Bisham Chafni u'Pinchas. It stresses he would go up to the Mishkan, and Chafni and Pinchas were there. Rav Avigdor Miller said that the stress is that part of his purpose of going to the Mishkan was in order to have the opportunity to talk Torah with them. Now, what actually happened? What went wrong with them? It wasn't that they were busy acting in this high-handed way, etc., and doing all the terrible things that are described. What happened was that Eli entrusted them with the care of the Mishkan. They made the mistake of saying that we want to set it up such that we can be primarily involved in our learning and personal growth. And they handed it over to a system of servants. That's what it says. It talks about the Na'arim and the Navi. A system of servants. And they figured we'll have a system in place. We'll be supervising from on top. And that's how it'll run. And that way we won't have to actually take so much time with the direct involvement. It didn't run well because the servants were not Eli, and they weren't Chafni and Pinchas either, and they actually turned it into something of what you might call a syndicate, like their own business, an enterprise that they were going to prosper from, that they were going to profit from, and things became corrupt very quickly. Their main crime was not being on top of things enough and not being on the scene enough in the way they should have, not relating to the responsibility of the Mishkan that they had in terms of the Mishkan itself and in terms of the way the Bnei Yisrael would relate to it. They didn't relate to that responsibility in the right way. That was the main blame on them. But in terms of who they were personally, on the contrary, Eli actually did a very great chinuch. Yet he's also blamed for not perfecting this aspect of the chinuch also, and not impressing on them enough the responsibility that they carried. That's what we'll call on one foot. But it's important to understand that in the broader perspective. It's like many other instances where the harsh words of the Navi have to be put into perspective and read between the lines. Okay,
thank you
very much, Kalta.
Thank you.
Thank you.